Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Ross, Judge Staubin, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our first case this morning, and I hope I pronounced this correctly, is Popovich versus Allina Health System et al. As I'm sure you're aware, you will have 15 minutes for your argument in chief, 15 minutes for rebuttal, and 5 minutes, 15 minutes for the appellant, 15 minutes for the respondent, and 5 minutes for rebuttal. I have never argued, so what do I know? Whenever you're ready, counsel, just approach the podium. It goes up and down, so adjust it to your level. And please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Brandon Thompson, representing the Popovich family, the appellant in this matter.
Thank you, Mr.
May I proceed?
Please. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Ostensible agency has been a fundamental part of Minnesota law for over a century. In McIlwain versus Van Beek, in just a couple of sentences, with no analysis whatsoever of either controlling case law, policy ramifications, or any other analysis of any kind, a three-judge panel of this court carved out an exception for one type of business to this long-standing legal principle. McIlwain was wrong when it was decided. It's still wrong today.
This has been around, 30-some years, hasn't it?
It has, Your Honor.
And so isn't that something that the Supreme Court should take care of, or the legislature or somebody like that?
Well, certainly we would have preferred it if the Supreme Court had taken up McIlwain.
Or perhaps
taken
you'll get your wish, depending on what we do.
We may well get our wish, and I suspect that regardless of what this panel does, there will be a request that the Supreme Court take up this issue and deal with it definitively.
God knows, considering what's going on at the Supreme Court, that's what I'd do these days.
So this is just your dress rehearsal, essentially.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I think that Mr. Weber and I would both agree that the likelihood is there will be a request that this go up to the Supreme Court. So there's essentially, there's a number of reasons why McIlwain should be overturned by this court. I know that stare decisis certainly is something that is near and dear to this court and certainly to this panel. But stare decisis, as the Supreme Court and this court have said many times, should not be an excuse for a mistake to be perpetuated. If compelling reasons exist for precedent to be overturned, then it is the duty of an appellate court to overturn that precedent. And there are a couple of compelling reasons presented to this court under these circumstances here today that were not present in McIlwain, and actually one of them was not present when the Kramer case was decided, and I want to talk about those. So there's essentially two holdings in McIlwain. The first holding was that Dr. Van Beek could not be held liable for the injuries to Georgiana McIlwain because there was no physician-patient relationship between the two of them. Just last week, in Warren versus Dinter, that's A170555, April 17th, 2019, Justice Lillehog writing the opinion, the Minnesota Supreme Court unequivocally stated that that holding in McIlwain was wrong. In fact, the language that the Supreme Court...
I think in all fairness, the syllabus point said it's usually required.
What's that?
I thought in the syllabus point it said a physician-patient relationship is usually required.
Well,
And would it be fair to say, and I don't want to cut you off in your argument, Mr. Thompson, I actually thought about that too. You know, believe it or not, we do read the Supreme Court opinions on Wednesday. I thought that was more of a foreseeability case rather than your case, which is obviously apparent authority. But obviously, you know, you're making a point, and I'll be happy to listen to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So you're right. The Warren case only dealt with the first of two holdings in McIlwain, but the importance to this case is this. What the Supreme Court said in Warren a week ago was that the Court of Appeals decisions requiring a physician-patient relationship, specifically McIlwain being one of them, was rest on an incorrect reading of Skilling's Supreme Court precedent. The Supreme Court went on to say that the conclusion in McIlwain misapprehends the holding in Skillings. The reason that's important here is that the Court of Appeals panel in McIlwain unquestionably, according to our own Supreme Court a week ago, misapprehended the holding and based their one of two holdings on an incorrect interpretation of Supreme Court precedent. The holding from McIlwain that we're dealing with here, the second holding, the conclusion that the hospital couldn't be held responsible for Dr. Van Beek's negligence because he was not an employee of the hospital, was based on, as the first holding was based on, a fundamental misunderstanding of the Skillings case. The holding we're dealing with here was based on a fundamental misinterpretation of the Moeller case. And it's noteworthy that Allina, in its response brief, does not seem to dispute that. They do not argue, nor could they, that the Moeller case actually stood for the proposition that a doctor could not be held vicariously liable, or that a hospital could not be held vicariously liable for an independent contractor physician. Moeller didn't say that. Moeller didn't come close to saying that. We pointed that out in our brief. And Allina didn't even respond to that in their brief. And the reason is, there is no credible argument that McIlwain was correct when it cited Moeller to support the proposition that vicariously liability could not lie with an independent contractor physician. No Minnesota Supreme Court ever held that. Before McIlwain, no court had held that. What the Minnesota Supreme Court had held for decades and decades and decades before McIlwain was that an independent contractor could be held liable under ostensible agency principles as long as certain elements were met. McIlwain took that away for hospitals. It is the only case that appellants are aware of, and respondents certainly haven't cited one, where any court in Minnesota has carved out an exception to ostensible agency for one type of business. Now, Allina, in their responsive brief, gives a host of policy reasons why such an exception may be appropriate. There's two problems with that. First, McIlwain didn't talk about any of those policy considerations at all. McIlwain spent two or three sentences on this issue. I think it's difficult to argue with a straight face that the McIlwain panel thought that what they were doing was carving out this exception to ostensible agency that was going to last 30 or more years and change the landscape with respect to one type of business to the exclusion of all others. Frankly, I think that the more thoughtful analysis shows that the McIlwain court just got it wrong. Just like they did in the first part of their holding where they misapprehended the Skillings case, in the second part of the McIlwain holding they misapprehended the Moeller case and they got it wrong. And the Kramer case didn't engage in any sort of analysis either. It didn't analyze, nor does it appear to have been presented with, the argument that this panel is presented with, which is that the Moeller case, that the McIlwain was wrongly decided because it just fundamentally misconstrued Moeller. The appellant in Kramer, with all respect to him, focused his analysis on what I think is really an ancillary issue in our brief, which is Minnesota is an outlier among all these other states, and we really should get in line with the other states. The point here, and the reason why this court can and should overrule McIlwain, is that it just flat out was based on a misunderstanding of Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. Now, the fact that—
Thompson, could you cite to any case where we have overruled a prior precedent from our own court?
I can't cite to one as I sit here right now. I'd certainly love the opportunity to look for one, but
you'd like this to be the one.
Yeah. I certainly would like this to be one, if not the first time. Certainly I hope that this will be one of them. And I think that the compelling reasons that are talked about in the Owens versus Allstate case really are here. Both because of the Warren case that just came down, and also because this issue about the misunderstanding of Moeller does not appear to have been presented to this court in the past, either in McElwain or in Kramer. Now, Alina, again, back to the point about the policy considerations, those were not raised in McElwain. They were not discussed in Kramer. Kramer was just a strict stare decisis decision, said McElwain's good law, we're going to follow it. The important thing about those policy considerations is that the same argument could be made about any ostensible agency case. Alina is basically saying it's not fair to hold a business responsible for the negligent actions of an independent contractor.
What's wrong with that?
Because it's not the law. That's what's wrong with it. Except for, because of McElwain, with respect to hospitals, the law is, as long as the plaintiff can prove the elements of ostensible agency, a business can be held responsible for the negligent acts of an independent contractor. That's the law today.
If there was a truck driver that they used in their industry, and the truck driver did something wrong, Alina would be responsible for that also?
Oh, Alina would be responsible for that. Maybe I misheard you, but the answer is Alina would be responsible for that.
Independent contractor.
That's right. Alina employs all sorts of different people. The only employee of Alina, or not employee, I'm sorry, Alina uses all sorts of people, all sorts of independent contractors. The only ones that are exempted from ostensible agency are the doctors. Now, Alina points out that, well, again, maybe there's some policy reasons why that would be good policy, but that's not what this court decided in McElwain. And that certainly isn't the sort of thing that the Court of Appeals should be doing, is weighing policy considerations and saying, well, okay, we're going to carve out this single exception for one type of business to the exclusion of all others. The fact of the matter is, this court and the Supreme Court have, for over a century, decided that it is fair to hold a business responsible for the negligent acts of an independent contractor. Now, Alina next turns to this question of reliance. And they spend a decent chunk of their brief talking about the question of reliance and making an argument that, well, it's unreasonable to think that Mr. or Mrs. Popovich actually relied on their expectation that the emergency room doctor was an employee of Alina. Well, that may well be true, it may not be true, but that's a Rule 56 issue. That's a discovery issue. It's a summary judgment issue. That's not a Rule 12 issue. Reliance is a fact question. And what the law says with respect to everybody else and every other kind of business, and as Your Honor points out, for an independent contractor truck driver who's delivering supplies for Alina, we would get to the jury on that. Or we would at least get to have discovery and get to develop a factual record and have the opportunity to prove that the elements of ostensible agency are present in this case. Now, I'll be the first to admit, Alina could well bring a motion for summary judgment, assuming this case is allowed to go forward. And if the district court decides that no reasonable jury could find the elements of ostensible agency under the specific facts of the specific case, then summary judgment could be appropriate. Maybe we would end up back here again. But the fact of the matter is, we should have the ability, like every other plaintiff in every other type of ostensible agency case against every other type of business, to have the opportunity to develop a factual record and to establish that the elements of ostensible agency are present. And if we do that, the claim should be allowed to go forward, just as it would against a truck driver or an insurance agency or an auto body shop or train company, or any other one of the host of businesses that Minnesota courts have either explicitly or implicitly allowed to be subject to an ostensible agency analysis. McElwain got it wrong. Kramer just parroted the language from McElveen. This court has the ability, under principles of stare decisis, to decide that a mistake should not be perpetuated if compelling circumstances exist that warrant that mistake be corrected. Given the fact that I think everybody in this room agrees that the holding in McElveen that we're talking about now was based on a fundamental misconstruction of Minnesota Supreme Court precedent, this court should take the opportunity to correct that mistake. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thompson. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Charles Weber for Allina Health System. The issue on appeal, as I think the court has gathered, is really whether this court should overrule two of its decisions. One decision.
One was not published.
Correct, yeah. One published decision, McElveen against Van Beek, which has been on the books for 30 years, and then effectively another, Kramer against St. Cloud Hospital, an unpublished decision from 7 years ago that expressly reaffirmed that McElveen, and I quote, remains good law in this state.
Can I take you right to the elephant in the room?
Yeah, sure.
Can you defend the proposition that McElveen accurately interpreted Moeller for the proposition that a hospital can be held vicariously liable only for a physician's act if the physician is an employee of the hospital?
Yeah, and in two ways. First, I would point out that it's certainly no way inconsistent with Moeller. Moeller said that for a doctor who was a direct employee of the hospital, there's liability. Didn't say the converse. But secondly, I'd point the court to a passage at, and this is in the Moeller decision, at 54 Northwest 2nd at 645. This is a passage where the Supreme Court remarked that it didn't seem reasonable to characterize the doctor in that case as an independent contractor while he performed routine hospital functions for the hospital. That indicates that the distinction that the Supreme Court was drawing in Moeller was a very firm distinction between independent contractor doctors and employee doctors, and signaled that independent contractor doctors, or that a hospital cannot be liable for the actions of independent contractor doctors, because that was the outcome. There was no reason for the Supreme Court to make that statement, to engage in that discussion, if they didn't believe that there was an important distinction between employee doctors and independent contractor doctors. And I think that McElveen absolutely was entitled to extend that holding or to recognize the holding of Moeller and to extend it a little bit. That's just common law adjudication. The courts do all the time. Not just slavishly following only what the court decides, but they're always applied to different circumstances, different factual circumstances, and sometimes
usually when that happens, there's some analysis that expresses this court or the appellate, whichever appellate court you're referring to, that court's basis for extending the law or precedent. And in this case, the McElveen court just cites Moeller as a C site without any discussion as to what you've described as an extension of the law.
Yeah, and I don't know that it's an extension of the law in the sense that it is adopting new law. I think it's really just application of Moeller to a set of circumstances that was a little bit different than there was in Moeller, perhaps.
Would you agree that if McElveen was relying upon Moeller for a proposition for which Moeller does not stand, and we conclude that this was a mistake, that would be a basis for this court to overrule McElveen?
I think it would be one factor to consider. This court has never engaged in the analysis of its precedents that says, well, if one panel thinks another panel was wrong, it's subject to overruling. There are, of course, a number of factors that the court considers. Length of time that precedent has been around, reliance interests, and the fact that the Supreme Court and the legislature can always correct if this court believes that, Supreme Court or the legislature believes that this court has erred as a matter of establishing law, they can correct that. But this court, I would absolutely agree that it is a factor, but it's not enough alone, and this court has never said that, and in fact has expressly said the opposite. The fact that one panel sort of disagrees with the analysis of another has never been ground enough to overturn a decision. And here are the other factors, as we pointed out, that this court normally considers in deciding whether to overrule a case, just aren't present here. This has been something that has been on the books for 30 years. My friend on the other side admits that lower courts have relied on it without any problem when this court has been willing to overturn a precedent. It's generally been in the circumstance where the current panel believes that the prior decision was wrong and is creating trouble for district courts. It's either creating confusion or difficulty of application. We don't have any of that here. This is a very straightforward rule that courts have lived with and, frankly, that hospitals and their insurers have accounted for and have relied on for the past 30 years. So if change is to come, it should come from another direction. But none of the other bases for overruling a decision are present here, even if this panel were to say, well, we don't think that McElwain's analysis was really that strong. That's not enough alone to overturn it. So I would not agree, obviously, with the proposition that if this panel believes that McElwain, even if it got it wrong, and I think the main complaint I see is that McElwain didn't really have a lengthy discussion of it, and that's true. Nobody can doubt that. But I think it was completely consistent with Moeller, and I think also a fair extension, not to a new area, but a fair reading of Moeller's very, very hard distinction between independent contractor doctors and employee doctors. And by the way, this is not a case where, you know, we've heard that McElwain and Kramer created a special rule for hospitals, a special exemption for an entire industry from apparent agency principles. That's not the case at all. What it did is it recognized that doctors, in particular, stand in a different relationship than other independent contractors that justifies not applying apparent agency principles to them. For example, if somebody from Allina, if Allina was holding somebody out as being able to contract for Allina, to enter into a supply contract, for example, and somebody did, and there was a breach of that contract, and then Allina tried to say, well, that person didn't have authority, they were an independent contractor, I don't think that there's any doubt that we would be subject to apparent agency principles there, and perhaps even a liability, assuming that all the elements of apparent agency were met. So this isn't a fact, this isn't a case, or this isn't a rule where hospitals are just get a blanket exemption from all apparent agency rules. It's just for doctors. And that relies on some very, very important and very worthwhile principles. One of them, for example, is the fact that the Supreme Court has adopted the tort of negligent credentialing. And that's the one thing that hospitals have control over when it comes to independent contractor doctors. We can afford them credentials, and that's all that we do. They have authority to practice. They have permission to practice and to render medical services in our facilities and use equipment that's owned by us, but they're not our employees, and we don't directly control their practice. And what the Supreme Court recognized in the Larson case was that there is a direct claim against hospitals in the event that they are negligent in credentialing somebody to perform their services in the hospital. And to us, that indicates, in the Supreme Court's decision and their discussion, indicates that the Supreme Court was very deliberate about saying expressly in Larson, this is not creating a species of vicarious or derivative liability for the hospital. This creates a direct claim against the hospital. And that makes sense in the sense that it puts liability, potential liability on the hospital for what it can control. And what it can control is its credentialing decision. But it does not control the practice of the doctors. And that is very consistent with what Moeller said and with a case that Moeller relied on that I want to call attention to, which is the St. Joseph's Hospital case, which was a case where even a hospital employee, a nurse, was held not to confer liability on the hospital because the nurse, the Supreme Court decided, was actually in the employ and was subject to the control of the doctor. And so if there was to be a claim based on the nurse's negligence, even though the nurse was an employee of the hospital, that liability fell on the doctor because the hospital didn't exercise control over the nurse in that particular circumstance. So the courts, Minnesota courts, have always been very strong on drawing a distinction between independent contractor doctors and direct employee doctors and ruling that if it's an independent contractor doctor, there is no indirect liability against the hospital. And as I said, that makes more sense now with the advent of the tort of negligent credentialing. It also makes sense given the fact that doctors stand in a different relationship, right? I can't think of any other business that operates with credentialing of people that perform essential services as opposed to direct employment of those people. And there also remains the fact that doctors are directly licensed by the state. The state of Minnesota regulates the practice of medicine. The state of Minnesota regulates their conduct. So this is not creating some vacuum where we're going to have a whole bunch of liability that goes unredressed. And I think those are among the factors, too, that would feed into the court's analysis of whether it should overrule these cases. The answer, and they all point to the direction that the court should not overrule the cases because this isn't creating some problem that needs to be fixed.
Mr. Weber, I was wondering if you would comment in the Kramer decision on Judge Mingy's concurrence and dissent, where he seems to be taking making some of the same points as Mr. Thompson is making.
Yeah. I see their brief basically as sort of being an an exposition on Judge Mingy's dissent, and obviously what I would point out
is the appellate public defenders always cite Judge Randall's dissent, so they're just following good practice.
Right. Well, and you know, just to point out the obvious, they're citing from a dissent. You know, Judge Mingy's views were obviously not agreed with by, I believe it was Judge Warkey, either Judge Warkey or Judge Larkin, who wrote the majority opinion, and then Judge Wright, former judge of this court, concurred in that opinion. So Judge Mingy's view is the dissent. We're not saying that it's an idiotic view. We're just saying that so far it has not been the prevailing view in this state and that it should remain so for all the reasons that we've set out in our brief. So I think that, you know, all of the reasons, all of the factors that this court normally looks to for whether it should overrule a case are simply not present here, even if, with a possible exception, if this court believes, if the panel believes that McElwain got it wrong, that would be a factor, one factor in favor of overruling, but all the others are not there, including the fact that this court has said things like, it is extremely reluctant, and that's a direct quote, to overrule its precedents, and that the reasons for departure from precedent must greatly outweigh the reasons for adhering to them. Just last week, this court said in the landmark, you know, the name of the case was Landmark, on April 15th, and it's at page 23 of the slip opinion, that this court is generally bound by its published opinions and requires some very, very compelling reasons to overturn them, usually doesn't do it unless there's some showing of confusion, some showing of difficulty applying the precedent, things like that.
Since the time of the briefing, obviously, the Supreme Court decided the Warren case, and you haven't had a chance to address the impact of that case on our analysis in this one. Would you please?
Sure, absolutely. And I agree that that case knocked out one of the two holdings of McElwain, which was the absence of the absolute necessity as a bright-line rule of a patient-physician relationship. But it did nothing to disturb the apparent agency holding. And this is actually one of the points in our brief when the argument is made that the apparent agency holding in McElwain was dicta. We've pointed out it was an alternative holding. This court issues alternative holdings all the time, for purposes of review in the Supreme Court, right? Here's our main holding. If you don't like that one, we've got another one. We think there are several reasons that uphold the decision. And of course, courts have said that alternative holdings are very much holdings. They're not dicta. That would present a great example of how that comes into play, right? McElwain issued two holdings, one of which was subsequently undercut by Supreme Court authority, but it did nothing to disturb the second holding. So the fact that one of the holdings has been undercut doesn't destroy the whole case. It has not overruled any of the apparent agency ruling of McElwain or of Kramer. It's why cases are often cited as overruled on other grounds, right? They remain good authority for the proposition that's cited, even if another proposition in the same case was later overruled. So, Your Honors, unless the court has any further questions, I would submit that this court should affirm the judgment below and decline to overrule McElwain and Kramer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ward.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Thompson, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome.
Mr. Weber just told the panel that according to this court's decision in Landmark from a week and a half ago, a panel's confusion about the application of precedent could be a reason for this court to overturn an existing case. That is exactly what happened in McElwain. McElwain didn't decide this vicarious liability issue based on these policy considerations that Alina has raised here today. They didn't decide it on those things. They didn't even talk about those things. And they certainly didn't decide it based on the fact that there's a tort of negligent credentialing recognized in Minnesota, because the Larson case that recognized negligent credentialing wasn't passed down until 18 years after McIlwain. McIlwain decided that it couldn't hold the hospital responsible for the negligence of an independent contractor doctor because the McIlwain panel thought that the Supreme Court's decision in Moeller compelled it to rule that way.
McIlwain, well, you know, even Judge Mingy said in his dissent, Moeller implies that the hospital is not liable for the malpractice of the independent physician. So do you agree that Moeller implies that?
No, okay. I don't. And I think that the passage that Mr. Weber cited to from Moeller actually says the opposite. I mean, the Moeller panel was explicitly saying it was not deciding the issue of an independent contractor because that wasn't the issue that was before it. So McIlwain thought that Moeller compelled it to issue the ruling that it did. Moeller didn't compel it to do that. Just like McIlwain thought that Skillings compelled it to find that Van Beek couldn't be held responsible because there wasn't a physician-patient privilege. McIlwain was wrong about that too. And because McIlwain, the panel in McIlwain, was confused about the application of precedent, that is exactly the sort of limited circumstance when this court should correct that mistake.
Your reply brief doesn't address the respondent's brief on the question of consistency with other jurisdictions. Your argument is that this McIlwain is an outlier, puts Minnesota out of step with all other states. Respondents say, no, it's not necessarily inconsistent, and it cites a few bases for that proposition. Would you please respond to the idea that McIlwain is not out of step?
Absolutely. So the responsive brief, I think, did a nice job of drawing some distinctions between Minnesota and other states. Actually, I don't think are all that meaningful of distinctions, quite frankly. The point is, yes, there are some states that allow hospitals to escape ostensible agency for independent contractor physicians by doing things like putting up signs that say the doctors here are not employees of the hospital, or taking other steps to make sure that a plaintiff cannot meet the elements of ostensible agency. But that's not what Minnesota says at all. I mean, if that were the rule in Minnesota, so they cite to, I think, Georgia and Texas and a couple of other states where that is the standard. If Minnesota hospitals did that, that would be fine. If Allina put up a sign or put on some form that the patient is required to sign that says, look, these emergency room doctors are not employees of Allina, a plaintiff would have a pretty tough row to hoe in claiming that they mistakenly thought that that doctor was an employee of the hospital. That could be used as a factual basis for getting out of ostensible agency, which is what those cases that Allina cites say. Those are factual issues, factual ways that a hospital got out of ostensible agency. This is different. The only states that have a rule like the one that McIlwain put out there are Colorado and Virginia. Colorado's got a specific statute. Virginia doesn't allow ostensible agency for anybody. Those are the two other states that fall in line with Minnesota. And then there are a handful of states that haven't issued a clear ruling one way or another. But the important thing is not just that Minnesota is an outlier with so many other states. It's that McIlwain is an outlier within Minnesota law with respect to the application of ostensible agency, a mistake that should be corrected. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Thank you, Mr. Weber. Ms. Case.
May it please the court. Opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I